We simply cannot allow people to pour into the United States undetected, undocumented, unchecked.
And complete the dang fence.
This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill.
Cast down your bucket where you are.
We come from France.
And I am, adamantly against illegal immigrants.
They're coming in by the thousands. Just unbelievable.
A wall is an immorality.
Who are you rooting for?
Those masters of the universe are at it again.
You maniac! You blew it up!
Welcome to Parsing Immigration Policy, the podcast of the Center for Immigration Studies. This is Mark Krikorian, Executive Director of the Center. And I'm a little under the weather, so my sound will be a little unusual. And so it's lucky that our podcast for this week is the presentations from a recent panel discussion that the Center hosted that included several members of the new International Network for Immigration Research on the topic of illegal immigration by sea. And maritime borders actually are much more difficult to police and patrol and prevent illegal immigration than land borders are. Certainly presents a different challenge, and really ultimately it's much more difficult to handle. And so speaking about this topic, we're going to have people from both sides of the Atlantic. Our first speaker will be Victor Marshai, who is director of the Migration Research Institute in Budapest, and he'll be talking about the EU's challenge in dealing with maritime illegal immigration, especially across the Mediterranean, and what are the problems this creates for the EU, how are they dealing with it, that sort of thing. The next speaker is going to be George Fishman from the Center for Immigration Studies, who will be talking about how the United States dealt with, specifically how we dealt with the legalities of Haitian seaborne illegal immigration in previous years, because that's the issue in the United States that's raised the most concern. As Haiti has disintegrated, the question is, will there be significant seaborne illegal immigration from there? And George talks about the Supreme Court decisions that actually facilitated dealing with illegal immigration by sea from Haiti specifically. And then third will be Eric Ruark from Numbers USA, who will be talking about some of the state policies related to controlling illegal immigration by sea. Obviously, Florida being the most important one since it has such a long coastline and it's next to the Caribbean, which is where much of the illegal immigration, whether from Cuba or Haiti, comes into the United States. So our first speaker will be Victor.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It's good to be here in DC again. Actually, already the third conference of the International Network for Immigration Research just within 6 months after the establishment. And yes, I would like to speak a little bit about the Mediterranean migration crisis and how it affects Europe. It's very important to underline that thanks to geographic reason, the European borders are relatively easily accessible both by land and sea, and it significantly shaped the illegal immigration landscape of Europe. Yet, it became a big topic only after the so-called Arab Spring 2011, which led to the collapse of certain state and governments, both in North Africa and the Middle East. And it led to the increasing number of irregular and illegal migration towards Europe, partly by land, but also across the sea. And in 2013, mainly Italy could observe a huge rise of illegal immigrants. More than 150,000 people reached Lampedusa, the Italian shores. And in the last decade, we could see the increasing number of arrivals, not only in the Central Mediterranean Sea, but also the other part of the Mediterranean and the Atlantic Ocean. It's important to underline that Europe reacted relatively fast in the land borders with the construction of physical barriers. Before the rise of this new crisis, only 300 kilometers physical barriers, fences, we could find around Europe. But after the crisis, almost 2,000 kilometer new fences were erected all around Europe, as you can see in the first map, mainly the eastern part of Europe, in the Western Balkan, but not exclusively. For example, we could see in French to stop the crossing the channel and the tunnel towards the United Kingdom. So we can say it was a relatively quick reaction from the European actors, which was very important. But in spite of the erection of the land border fences, the number of people crossing the Mediterranean and the sea increased significantly. In the second map, we can see that most irregular arrival to Europe happens by sea in the eastern Mediterranean, in the biggest number currently in the central Mediterranean, the western Mediterranean, and in the Atlantic Ocean. And last but not least, we have to emphasize the crossing in the British Channel from France to the United Kingdom. Closing and blocking sea borders was always a challenge for not only Europe, but all other actors because of different reasons. First and foremost, big part of them are international waters which share responsibilities. So, with the exception of the territorial waters, which are very close to the certain states and which are part of the different nations, the high sea is an international area with many different actors who are operating on these areas, which share obligations and responsibilities, for example, in the save and rescue operations. And besides states, we can find different actors. For example, NGOs, which play a significant role in the current crisis, even if we have to underline that they are rescuing only between 10 and 15% of all people in the Mediterranean. But actually, because of the rule of the sea, each vessel are obliged to save people who are in trouble in the waters. And it is utilized by human smuggling networks, which regularly use small boats with a lot of people, with bad shape, the boats, counting that they will start to sink, and each vessel in the region will be obliged to try to save the people there. If we are moving to the third map, in the central Mediterranean, as an example, we can see these overlapping responsibilities. Both Italy and later the European Union started different missions to save people who are trying to cross, but they try to do it mainly close to the Italian shores, while they try to cooperate with the Libyan Coast Guard to stop the boats to leave North Africa. But between the two zones, we could find NGO ships which served some kind of taxi service for the migrants and the human smuggling networks. Actually, it also increased the perception of human smugglers that they don't have to use proper boats to transfer people from North Africa to Lampedusa and the Italian shores, because they knew that, and they still know, that the NGOs will save people. And if not, it's not their problem. It's unfortunately the problem who people are drawn into the Mediterranean. So actually, the gap between the EU operations and the national obligations, for example, Italy and Malta, are filled by the NGOs who are operating in the region. If we move to the fourth map, it's also very visible that the distance between North Africa, namely Tunisia and Libya, is very small. Comparing the ocean shield, which is protects the United States. For example, the distance between Sfax and Lampedusa is just 200 kilometers, so 130 miles. It's relatively easily accessible by small boats. It's not accidental that hundreds of boats are arriving annually to the small island of Lampedusa. And with the exception of the stormy weathers in the Mediterranean at the beginning and at the end of the year, actually the crossing are ongoing the whole year. And last year we could see more than 170,000 crossing in this small gap between Europe and Africa, mostly but not exclusively African citizens, but we could see, for example, other nationalities, Bangladeshis, Syrians, who try to reach somehow African capitals and cross the Sahara, and then they try to reach Europe. What are the solutions? In the Eastern Mediterranean, we can see that, for example, the Greek island and Cyprus itself, an independent country, even if it can be considered as detention, but they are closed. So even if people arrive to the Greek islands, which are just a couple of miles from the Turkish shores, it's not easy for them to move further. They can do it only if there is collaboration with the authorities. So it's a problematic case. Why Cyprus? Why still it's the part of the Schengen area, of the European Union, it's not part of the Schengen area. So it's also hard for the people to move there from Cyprus to the European Union. But it's not the case, for example, about Lampedusa in Italy. So the strategies of the recent years are mainly the externalization, the different forms of externalization of the combat against illegal immigration. One is the cooperation with third countries, the so-called gatekeepers, to stop the embarkation from the North African and Middle Eastern shores. The EU established collaboration with Egypt, Morocco, the Libyan Coast Guard, which are relatively effective, but of course they can stop all crossing in the sea. The other form of externalization is some kind of outsourcing asylum procedures. There are certain attempts by Denmark, a EU country, and the United Kingdom, which is not an EU country, how they can outsource asylum procedures. This is the so-called Rwanda deal, which is under negotiation, but there's no any achievement in this case. What was an achievement, and perhaps it can be the next step, which must be considered by the European capitals and Brussels itself, is the Italian-Albanian deal, because Rome made an excellent agreement with the Albanian parties. If they stop the boats in international waters far from the territory of the EU, they can transfer them to a third safe country, in this case Albania. And the first part of the asylum procedure is ongoing there, outside of the EU territory and outside of EU legislation, which make possible or more easy for Italy to relocate these people if they don't have any chance to get international protection in the European Union. This is an early stage, this cooperation, but it seems that even the EU and the Commission accepted it as a possible solution. A lot of member states are watching this closely, whether it can work or not. And according to my assumption, it can be a solution for boats besides the collaboration with third countries. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is George Fishman.
In 1993, the Supreme Court gave the executive branch the go-ahead to prevent a Haitian migration crisis by sea. Not mincing words, the court concluded that it is perfectly clear that the Immigration and Nationality Act grants the president ample power to establish a naval blockade that would simply deny illegal Haitian migrants the ability to disembark on our shores. I read this to mean that DHS can interrupt Haitian marine flotillas in international waters and return the intending illegal migrants to Haiti without having to entertain and adjudicate claims for asylum, for withholding of removal, based on possible persecution. Thus, President Biden has the green light to prevent any new Haitian migration crisis by sea, should he want to. I'm going to briefly outline the history of the Haitian migration crises since George H.W. Bush's presidency, and then discuss what exactly the Supreme Court ruled and why it ruled that way. I'll also discuss the main legal issue that is still really undecided, which is, does DHS have the same latitude to intercept boats from Haiti or other countries in U.S. territorial waters and return the occupants without screening them for purported fears of persecution and things of that nature? And that would affect areas between possibly 3 or 12 miles from the U.S. coastline. So in September 1981, President Reagan issued a proclamation in which he found that the continuing illegal migration by sea of large numbers of undocumented aliens into the southeastern U.S. was a serious national problem, detrimental to the interests of the United States. He suspended the entry of illegal aliens from the high seas and ordered the Coast Guard to intercept vessels carrying them and to return them from whence they came. However, President Reagan's order explicitly said no person who is a refugee will be returned without his consent. The Supreme Court in the 1993 decision, Sale versus Haitian Centers Council, described what happened next. In the ensuing decade, the Coast Guard interdicted approximately 25,000 Haitian migrants. After interviews conducted on board Coast Guard cutters, aliens who are identified as economic migrants were screened out and promptly repatriated. Those who made a credible showing of political refugee status were screened in and transported to the U.S. for formal applications for asylum. In September 1991, a group of military leaders displaced the Haitian government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Since the coup, hundreds of Haitians had been killed, tortured, detained without a warrant, or subjected to violence or the destruction of their property because of their political beliefs, in the words of the Supreme Court. During the 6 months after October 1991, the Coast Guard interdicted over 34,000 Haitians. Because so many could not be safely processed on Coast Guard cutters, the Department of Defense established facilities at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba to accommodate them during the screening process for withholding of removal. Those temporary facilities, however, had a capacity of only about 12,500 persons. In the first 3 weeks of May 1992, the Coast Guard intercepted over 100 vessels carrying over 10,000 illegal aliens, or intending illegal aliens. In May 1992, the United States Navy determined that no additional migrants could safely be accommodated at Guantanamo. So, what to do? What was President Bush to do? As the Supreme Court put it, he had a decision to make. With both the facilities at Guantanamo and available Coast Guard cutters saturated, and with the number of Haitian emigrants in unseaworthy craft increasing, many had drowned as they attempted the trip to Florida, the government could no longer both protect our borders and offer the Haitians even a modified screening process. It had to choose between allowing Haitians into the U.S. for screening or repatriating them without giving them the opportunity to establish their qualifications as refugees. In the judgment of the president's advisors, the first choice not only would have defeated the original purpose of the interdiction program, controlling illegal immigration, but also would have impeded diplomatic efforts to restore democratic government in Haiti and would have posed a life-threatening danger to thousands of persons embarking on long voyages in dangerous craft. So what did President Bush do? As the court wrote, he adopted the second choice. He directed the Coast Guard to intercept vessels illegally transporting passengers from Haiti to the U.S. and to return those passengers to Haiti without first determining whether they may qualify as refugees. And after assuming office, President Clinton decided to not modify that decision and to keep that policy. I actually have a friend who told me he was in the State Department at the time and watched the Haiti policy come together. And during the election campaign, they were attacked by the Clinton campaign. And then the Clinton campaign or the Clinton administration decided to keep the policy anyway. And my friend asked people within the Clinton administration what was going on. And the response was, yes, we have the same policy, but we feel bad about it. So I guess that was the difference between the Bush administration and the Clinton administration. In any event, President Bush issued an executive order relying on his powers under the Immigration and Nationality Act to suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose upon the entry of aliens any restrictions appropriate when he finds that the entry of such aliens would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. His order provided, in part, President Reagan's proclamation suspended the entry of all undocumented aliens into the U.S. by the high seas. Appropriate instructions shall be issued to the Coast Guard in order to enforce the suspension of the entry of undocumented aliens by sea and the interdiction of any defined vessels carrying such aliens. It goes on. But in any event, these actions are authorized to be undertaken only beyond the territorial sea of the United States. That was part of the president's decision. And the order shall not be construed to require any procedure to determine whether a person is a refugee. Obviously, litigation ensued. The administration was sued. litigants were seeking a temporary restraining order to prevent implementation of the order, contending that it violated the Immigration and Nationality Act's mandate of withholding of removal, that no alien be returned, removed to a country where their life or freedom would be endangered, essentially where it was more likely than not that they would be persecuted, got up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled the president has directed the Coast Guard to intercept vessels illegally transporting passengers from Haiti and to return those passengers to Haiti without first determining whether they may qualify as refugees. The question presented is whether such forced repatriation, authorized to be undertaken only beyond the territorial seas of the U.S., violates the Immigration and Nationality Act's withholding of removal provision. That was the decision for the Supreme Court. In an 8-1 decision, the court affirmed the federal government's ability to repatriate aliens interdicted on the high seas without having to screen them for withholding, ruling that neither the withholding statute nor the refugee protocol to which the U.S. is a signatory applies to actions taken by the Coast Guard on the high seas beyond the territorial sea of the U.S. That's the go-ahead, the green light that President Biden has should he decide to utilize it. What was the court's rationale? Some of the court's rationales are still apply under current law. Some have been rendered OBE, overtaken by events, because of changes in the law. But let me quickly summarize them. The first, the withholding of removal statute says the attorney general cannot return, remove an alien in those circumstances. And the court ruled we cannot say that the interdiction program created by the president, which the Coast Guard was ordered to enforce, usurped authority that Congress has delegated to the attorney general alone. The reference to the attorney general in the statutory text is significant because that term cannot reasonably be construed to describe either the president or the Coast Guard. It's interesting that since that decision, the Department of Homeland Security was created and the Coast Guard was actually placed in the Department of Homeland Security. So that rationale would no longer suffice under current law. But the Supreme Court's main decision, what main rationale, was that the withholding of removal mandate only applies in areas where removal proceedings can be conducted, because that is where withholding of removal is considered. Removal proceedings occur in the United States, not outside the United States, and therefore nothing that occurs outside the United States is subject to the withholding mandate. As I indicated, I'll just briefly note that it's still an open question as to whether the same policy can be undertaken in the territorial waters of the United States. But Walter Dellinger, President Clinton's Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, and later President Clinton's Solicitor General, issued an opinion in 1993 that yes, the same rules apply in U.S. territorial waters. Aliens can be returned, repatriated without screening for withholding of removal for asylum. That's never been tested in court, but Mr. Dellinger was a liberal icon. He has made a very compelling case, and I would hope that courts would consider it.
And finally, Eric Ruark.
In the U.S., we aren't facing the same challenges at the present time that they are in the European Union or in the UK when it comes to irregular migration across open waters, because our southern border is so very easy for people to walk across. With Texas and now Florida and likely other states who are going to take steps to attempt to prevent illegal immigration, this may change illegal immigration patterns. Certainly political instability in Latin America and the Caribbean, particularly in Haiti, at the moment, will also provide future challenges. And when we talk about political instability, certainly in Haiti, that's a longstanding problem that we faced. And George touched on a lot of the issues that we faced in the 90s. So, you know, I would say that the United States is not well equipped to deal with this potential change in illegal immigration patterns. And it's a political challenge more so than a legal one. We do have the President of the United States, despite what he may say, has the legal authority to take action to stop this. Whether he will or not, or whether he will be compelled to, is the ultimate question. And we were talking about, you know, what we were going to, the topic of this panel would be, you know, the political situation in Haiti was at the forefront of the news. And we were expecting to see more illegal crossings by boat. And Governor DeSantis certainly was anticipating this, or at least politically, he was thinking he needed to get out in front of this by saying that he was going to take action, or he was going to task Florida law enforcement with taking action to interdict boats that may come from Haiti. And as George pointed out, there are laws and legal protocols in place to deal with migrants who are attempting to land. The ultimate goal is to land within the United States, coming by sea. Clearly, the United States has the authority to prevent this, but there are questions about where you interdict these boats. Are you doing it in U.S. territorial waters, or are you doing it on the high seas in international waters? And again, the volume of illegal immigration that's coming across the Caribbean is not as high as we're seeing in the Mediterranean or the English Channel, though it has increased under the Biden administration compared to the recent past. What we now see is a few thousand people coming in as opposed to a few hundred previous to the Biden administration. But again, this pales in comparison to the millions of people who are coming across or through Central America and Mexico and crossing the southern border of the United States and who are being released into the United States by our government. We also see people who are flying in, and CIS certainly did a good job of publicizing what might not be a secret program, but certainly is not well publicized by the Biden administration for obvious reasons. And, you know, I would raise the question, has Biden's humanitarian parole program stopped more boats from coming? I would say probably. We can't prove one way or the other, but I think it's a reasonable thing to suggest that it's sort of been a pressure valve for people who aren't coming in, who want to come in, are being allowed to come in through these programs, which we would, I know George would agree, are an abuse of the president's parole authority. I would also suggest that if there's one thing we want to credit the Biden administration for doing to stop illegal immigration, we can say they prevented lots of boats from coming over. Whether that's because people are finding other ways to get in is another question, but the Biden administration hasn't had to deal with that. What for previous administrations, the Bush administration and certainly Clinton administration, were political headaches. And really the task that the Biden administration has set for itself isn't stopping illegal immigration, it's managing its flow. How to best manage the flow and so that the political optics are, at least in their opinion, in their favor. And I would also point out that there was an agreement with the Mexican president or the government of Mexico. We don't know exactly what that agreement was, but we do know that the Mexicans are doing something on their end. And how long that will persist and how tough they will be in preventing illegal immigration, I think is an open question. But if Mexico continues to prevent the flow through Mexico, will people then feel the necessity to try to get here by sea? Yes, there are obvious logistical challenges involved, resources, manpower, command and control of sea borders. I think anyone who's ever been on the open water understands how much more dangerous it is than being on land. These dangers are compounded with, as George pointed out, many of the migrants who are coming aren't traveling on necessarily very seaworthy vessels. And so we have the obligation to make sure that these people are, if we possible, that are rescued or at least conveyed safely somewhere so that they're not drowning in the seas. And the dangerous journeys, and we see it across land borders as well, the reason that people are making these journeys is because they believe, quite rightfully when it comes to the United States, that they're going to be allowed into the United States. The way to prevent boats is to interdict them, first of all, in the open waters and send them back. But the other thing is the people who do end up making it to the United States aren't going to be released into the United States to reside, to work, to remain for long term, that they will be detained until they have an immigration hearing. That will stop people from making the dangerous journey by land or by sea. In our last panel, I talked about how the majority of inadmissible aliens who are entering the U.S. aren't claiming asylum, and those who do most of them will have their asylum claims rejected if they go through the adjudication process. Despite this fact, illegal border crossers are still often portrayed in political debates and in media reports as somehow having the right under U.S. law to enter, to reside, and to work in the country. And I would borrow a famous legal phrase from the U.S., the penumbra. They're coming under the penumbra of asylum law. And what I mean by that is this encompasses anyone coming from anywhere in the world who is trying to escape poverty or areas of high crime or referred to as climate refugees, or simply want to come to work in the United States because they want a better life. Not everyone is getting into the United States, but almost everyone is getting in, according to the DHS secretary. I think it was Woody Allen that said, 85% of success is just showing up. Well, that's about what it is for the people who are showing up at the U.S. border. Their success of getting into the country is very high. And so when people push back and say it's not open borders, it's pretty close. The challenge of establishing operational control over our land and sea borders is real, but it's not the main impediment that we face. The main impediment is that our federal government is run by one political party that acts as if the rule of law is irrelevant to the functioning of our immigration system, and another party that complains a lot about the abrogation of law, but then votes to fund its continuation. In February, the U.S. House of Representatives impeached Secretary of Department of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas, only the second time this has happened in U.S. history, and then 2 weeks ago voted to fund the very policies that he implemented for which he was impeached. In January, I spoke about how this is a genuine constitutional crisis that we're facing. I don't think anyone can make a convincing argument that President Biden is faithfully executing his duties to carry out the laws as passed by Congress. And Mark asked me in January, what do you do when you have an executive who won't enforce immigration law? And I think that's the million-dollar question, or I guess in today's inflationary terms, the trillion-dollar question. You know, what are we going to do about this? And, you know, I want to touch on what George and Victor have raised and sort of put that in the context of practical applications of dealing with how to stop this. I'll say, to compare it to what we see in the EU, we have individual countries who are trying to implement specific policy, immigration policies, to deal with specific national interests and challenges that they're facing. And a lot of pushback is coming from the EU government in Brussels. I think we compare that somewhat to what's happening in the United States. Immigration policy is set in Washington, D.C. at the federal level, but we see the effects felt at state and local levels. And what is the role for state and local governments to play? I ran this by George earlier this week, and you know, my argument is it's very much an open question as to what states can do. And George said to me, well, you're not wrong, which is about the highest praise I think you can have from a lawyer. So briefly, just
you paid your bill on time. I think that would be
okay. Yeah. When we're looking at Texas with SB 4, which allows Texas law enforcement to arrest people who are coming over the border illegally, or we're seeing what Governor DeSantis does, which is to prevent people from coming into this to the state by boat, there's a difference between what we do see the states being allowed to do, which is to, for instance, mandatory e-verify or deal with people and have consequences for people who are in the state already illegally, as opposed to trying to prevent people from entering their borders, foreign nationals from entering their borders. It's a very different question. And I think that's very much open for the courts to decide. And the way we see the Supreme Court deal with these issues with Texas and other states, I think will largely determine the future of immigration policy, particularly when we have an executive who doesn't want to enforce the law. And so I would say my main point here is we're not seeing a lot of boats coming from Haiti or elsewhere. That may change depending on what we see the Mexican government do or states do as well. And I don't think that our immigration system is able to respond to a genuine crisis like we're going to see continue in Haiti. It's would be very optimistic to think that Haiti is going to be stabilized politically in short order. This is a problem we've been dealing with for decades. I think it's a problem we're going to have to deal with for many more years. And our federal government at this time basically has set up a system which is unable to respond to acute crises, but also has sent in the message, has sent the message out that if you come to the United States, we're going to let you in as an economic migrant, and that hinders our ability to deal with refugees and asylees in a practical manner, whether they're coming by land or by sea.
That's it for this episode of Parsing Immigration Policy. The full panel discussion, including the question and answer session, is available on our website, cis.org, and we'll have a link in the show notes as well. If you have any questions, comments, complaints, suggestions for future programs, please email us at center@cis.org. And if you get this podcast on a platform that allows you to rate or review the podcast, please do so. It raises the visibility of the podcast. And until our next episode, thanks for tuning in.